this. The girl, sir, just like I was told to fetch.
That isn't any girl.
Yes, sir, she's the one.
But it's hair.
It's clothes. I only do what I'm instructed, Mr. Thomas. If you have any queries, I suggest you take them up with Mr. Mansell. He was with me when I fetched her. This news seemed to mollify Mr. Thomas somewhat. He forced a sigh through tight lips. I suppose if Mr. Mansell was satisfied. The coachman nodded. If that's all, I'll be getting the horses stabled. Eliza considered running after Mr. Newton and his horses, seeking refuge in the stables, hiding in a carriage and finding her way somehow back to London. But when she looked after him, he'd already been enveloped by the fog, and she was stranded.
Come,
said Mr. Thomas, and Eliza did as she was bade. Inside was cool and dank, though warmer and drier than outside. Eliza followed Mr. Thomas along a short hallway, trying to keep her feet from clipping on the grey flagstones. The air was thick with the smell of roasting meat, and Eliza felt her stomach flip over. When had she last eaten? A bowl of Mrs. Swindle's broth 2 days before? A piece of bread and cheese that the coachman had given her many hours ago? Her lips grew dry with sudden hunger. The smell was stronger as they walked through a huge, steamy kitchen. A cluster of maids and a fat cook stopped their conversation to observe. As soon as Eliza and Mr. Thomas had passed, they erupted in a rush of excited whispering. Eliza could have wept for having been so close to food. Her mouth watered as if she'd swallowed a handful of salt. At the end of the hall, a skinny woman, with a face made stiff by exactitude, stepped from a doorway.
"This is the niece, Mr. Thomas?"
Her direct gaze travelled slowly down Eliza's person.
"It is, Mrs. Hopkins."
"There has been no mistake?"
"Regrettably not, Mrs. Hopkins."
"I see."
She drew in a slow breath.
"She certainly has the look of London about her."
This, Eliza could tell, was not to her advantage.
"Indeed, Mrs. Hopkins," said Mr. Thomas. "I was of a mind to have her bathed before presenting her."
Mrs. Hopkins' lips tightened, a sharp, decisive sigh.
"Though I agree with your sentiment, Mr. Thomas, I'm afraid there isn't time. She has already let us know of her displeasure at being kept waiting."
She. Eliza wondered who she was. A certain agitation crept into Mrs. Hopkins's manner when the word was spoken. She brushed quickly at her already smooth skirts.
"The girl is to be taken to the drawing room. She will be along presently. Meanwhile, I'll draw a bath, see if we can't remove some of that horrid London filth before dinner."
So there was to be dinner, and soon. Eliza was light-headed with relief. A giggle from behind, and Eliza turned just in time to see a curly-haired maid disappear back towards the kitchen.
"Mary," said Mrs. Hopkins, stalking after the maid, "you'll wake one morning and trip over your own ears if you don't learn to stop them flapping."
At the very end of the hall, a set of narrow stairs ran up, then turned towards a wooden door at the top. Mr. Thomas went briskly, and Eliza followed, through the door, and into a large room. The floors were covered with pale rectangular flagstones, and a magnificent staircase swept up from the centre of the room. A chandelier was suspended from the high ceiling, its candles tossing tissues of soft light onto all below. Mr. Thomas crossed the entrance foyer and moved towards a door, thick with glistening red paint. He inclined his head, and Eliza realized he meant for her to come. His pale lips quivered as he looked down at her. Little lines puckered.
"The mistress, your aunt, will be down to see you in a minute. Mind your P's and Q's and call her my lady, unless she bids you do otherwise."
Eliza nodded. She was her aunt. Mr. Thomas was still looking at her. He shook his head slightly without removing his gaze.
Yes, he said in a quick, quiet voice. I can see your mother in you. You're a tatty little wench, no mistake about it, but she's in there somewhere.
Before Eliza could try on for size the pleasant notion that she was somehow like mother, there was a noise at the top of the grand staircase. Mr. Thomas stopped, straightened. He gave Eliza a little prod, and she stumbled alone across the threshold into a large room with burgundy wallpaper and a fire raging in the hearth. Gas lamps flickered on the tops of tables, but despite their best efforts, they couldn't hope to light the enormous room. Darkness whispered in the corners. Shadows breathed along the walls. Back and forth. Back and forth. A noise behind, and the door opened again. A gust of cold air set the fire to spitting in the grate, hurled jagged shadows against the walls. With a shiver of anticipation, Eliza turned. A tall, thin woman stood in the doorway, her body an elongated hourglass. Her long dress, blue silk as deep as the midnight sky, clung to her figure. A huge dog, no, not a dog, a hound, stood by her, long legs prancing as he worried close, stalking about the hem of her dress. He lifted his knobbled head every so often to rub against her hand. "Miss Eliza," announced Mr. Thomas, who had hurried in behind the woman and now stood to attention. The woman did not respond, but studied Eliza's face. She was silent for a minute before her lips parted and a flinty voice emerged. "I must speak with Newton tomorrow. She comes later than expected." She spoke so slowly, so surely, that Eliza could feel the sharp corners of her words.
"Yes, my lady," said Thomas, cheeks flaming. "Shall I bring the tea, my lady? Mrs. Hopkins has..."
"Not now, Thomas." Without turning, she gave a vague flutter of her pale, fine hand. "You should know better than that. It's far too late for tea."
"Yes, my lady."
"If word should travel that tea had been taken at Blackhurst Manor after dark..." A tight, crystal-breaking laugh. "No, we'll wait for dinner now."
"In the dining room, my lady?"
"Where else?"
"Set for two, my lady?"
"I will dine alone."
"And Miss Eliza, ma'am?"
The aunt inhaled sharply. "A light supper."
Eliza's stomach groaned. Please God that her meal would contain some warm meat.
"Very good, my lady," said Mr. Thomas, bowing as he left the room. The door sealed glumly behind him. The aunt drew a long, slow breath and blinked at Eliza. "Come closer then, child. Let me look at you." Eliza obeyed, walked towards her aunt and stood, trying to silence breaths that had grown unaccountably quick. Close up, the aunt was beautiful. It was the type of beauty exemplified in each feature, but diminished somehow by the whole. Her face was like that in a painting. Skin as white as snow, lips as red as blood, eyes of palest blue. Looking into her eyes was like staring at a mirror with a light shone upon it. Her dark hair was smooth and shiny, swept back from her face and gathered richly at the crown of her head. The aunt's gaze picked over Eliza's face and her eyelids seemed to flicker slightly. Cold fingers lifted Eliza's chin, all the better to observe her. Eliza, unsure where to look, blinked at those impassable eyes. The giant dog stood by his mistress, breathing warm, damp air onto Eliza's arms. "Yes," the aunt said, the S sound lingering on her lips and a nerve twitching at the side of her mouth. It was as if she answered a question that had not been asked. You are her daughter. Reduced in all ways, but hers nonetheless. She shivered slightly as a scud of rain hit the windows. The foul weather had finally found them. We must only hope your nature is not the same, that with timely intervention we can arrest any similar tendencies. Eliza wondered what these tendencies might be. My mother...
No,
the aunt raised her hand.
No.
She steepled her fingers before her mouth, strangled her lips into a thin smile.
Your mother brought shame upon her family's name, offended against all who live in this house. We do not speak of her here. Ever. This is the first and most important condition of your accommodation at Blackhurst Manor. Do you understand?
Eliza bit her lip.
Do you understand?
An unexpected tremor had entered the aunt's voice. Eliza nodded slightly, more from surprise than agreement.
Your uncle is a gentleman. He understands his responsibility.
The aunt's eyes flickered in the direction of a portrait by the door. A man of middle years with ginger hair and a fox-like expression. But for his red hair, he was nothing like Eliza's mother.
You must remember always how fortunate you are. Work hard that you might some day deserve your uncle's generosity.
Yes, my lady, said Eliza, remembering what Mr. Thomas had said. The aunt turned and pulled a small lever on the wall. Eliza swallowed, dared to speak.
Excuse me, my lady, she said softly. Am I to meet my uncle?
Her aunt's left eyebrow arched. Thin pleats appeared briefly on her forehead before smoothing once more to give the appearance of alabaster.
My husband has been in Scotland taking photographs of Brecon Cathedral and is not due back until tomorrow.
She came close, and Eliza was aware of tension emanating from her body.
Although he has offered you accommodation, your uncle is a busy man, an important man, a man not given to the interruptions of children.
She pressed her lips so tightly that their color was briefly bleached.
You must stay out of his way always. It is kindness enough that he has brought you here. Do not be seeking more. Do you understand?
The lips quivered.
Do you understand?
Eliza nodded quickly.
Then, blessedly, the door was open, and Mr. Thomas was there again.
You rang, my lady?
The aunt's eyes were still focused on Eliza.
The child needs cleaning.
Yes, my lady. Mrs. Hopkins has already fetched the water.
The aunt shivered. Have her put some carbolic in it. Something strong, sufficient to remove that London grime.
She spoke under her breath.
Would that it removed all else with which I fear she's been tainted.
Still raw from the scrubbing she'd received, Eliza followed the flickering of Mrs. Hopkins's lantern up a flight of cold wooden stairs and into another hallway. Long-dead men leered at them from heavy gilt frames, and Eliza thought how ghastly it must be to have one's portrait painted, to sit still for so long, all so that a layer of oneself could be left forever on a canvas, hung lonely in a darkened corridor. She slowed. The final painting's subject she recognized. It was different from that in the room downstairs. In this one, he was younger. His face was fuller, and there was little hint of the fox that would later gnaw its way to the surface. In this portrait, in this young man's face, Eliza saw her mother.
"That there's your uncle," said Mrs. Hopkins without turning. You'll meet him in the flesh soon enough.
The word flesh made Eliza aware of the flecks of pink and cream paint that lingered on the portrait in the grooves of the artist's final strokes. She shivered, remembering Mr. Mansell's pale, moist fingers.
Mrs. Hopkins stopped before a door at the dim end of the hallway, and Eliza hurried after, still clutching Sammy's clothing to her chest.
The housekeeper withdrew a large key from a fold in her dress and inserted it into the lock, pushed open the door, and started through, lantern held aloft. The room was dark, the lantern cast only the dimmest light across its threshold. In the center, Eliza could make out a bed of shiny black wood, four posts that looked to have upon them engraved figures climbing towards the ceiling. On the bedside table was a tray with a piece of bread and a bowl of soup from which steam no longer rose. No meat to be seen, but beggars couldn't be choosers, as Mother used to say. Eliza fell upon the bowl and spooned the soup into her mouth so fast she swallowed a set of hiccups. She ran the bread around the bowl so as not to waste a smear. Mrs. Hopkins, who had been watching with a somewhat stunned expression, made no comment. She continued stiffly, set down the lantern on a wooden box at the foot of the bed, and pulled back the heavy blanket. "There you are, then. Climb in. I haven't all night." Eliza did as she was told. The sheets were cold and damp beneath her legs, sensitive after their fierce scouring. Mrs. Hopkins took the lantern, and Eliza heard the door close behind her. And then she was alone in the pitch-dark room, listening as the house's tired old bones creaked beneath its shiny skin. The darkness of the bedroom had a sound, Eliza thought, a low, distant rumbling. Ever-present, always threatening, never coming close enough to be revealed as something harmless. And then it started to rain again, heavy and sudden. Eliza shivered as a flash of lightning split the sky into two jagged halves and threw light across the world. In those moments of illumination, always followed by a crack of thunder that made the giant house shake, she scanned the room one wall at a time, trying to make out her surroundings. Flash, crack, dark wooden wardrobe beside the bed. Flash, crack, fireplace against the far wall. Flash, crack, ancient rocking chair by the window. Flash, crack, a window seat. On tiptoes, Eliza crossed the cold floor. Wind slipped through the cracks in the timbers and rushed along its surface. She climbed onto the window seat that had been built into the nook and looked out across the dark grounds. Angry clouds had shrouded the moon, and the garden sat beneath a cloak of troubled night. Needles of driving rain pelted the sodden ground. Another flash of lightning, and the room was lit once more. As the light faded, Eliza caught a glimpse of her reflection in the window. Her face. Sammy's face. Eliza reached out, but the image had already faded, and her fingers merely brushed the icy glass. She knew, in that moment, more than any before, that she was a long way from home. She went back to bed and slid between the cold, damp, unfamiliar sheets. Placed her head on Sammy's shirt. Closed her eyes and drifted amongst the reedy fringe of sleep. Suddenly she sat bolt upright. Her stomach turned and her heart beat faster.
Mother's brooch! How could she have forgotten? In all the hurry, with all the drama, she had left it behind. High up in the chimney cavity, in Mr. and Mrs. Swindle's house, Mother's treasure waited.
Chapter 22. Cornwall, 2005. Cassandra dropped a tea bag into a cup and switched on the kettle. As it worked itself up to steaming, she gazed towards the window. Her room was at the back of the Blackhurst Hotel, facing out to sea, and though it was dark, Cassandra could still make out some of the rear gardens. A clipped, kidney-shaped lawn sloped away from the terrace towards a line of tall trees, blue beneath the moon's silvery light. That was the cliff face, Cassandra knew. Those trees, the last line of defense on this particular piece of earth. Somewhere beyond the cove was the town itself. Cassandra hadn't seen much of it yet. The train trip had taken most of the day, and by the time the taxi wove its way through the back hills of Tregenna, daylight was fading quickly to darkness. Only briefly, as the car mounted a crest, had she glimpsed a circle of twinkling lights in the cove below, like a fairy village materializing with the dusk. As she waited for the water to boil, Cassandra thumbed the dog-eared edge of Nell's notebook. She'd had it out during much of the train trip, had imagined that her time could be well spent unraveling the next stage of Nell's journey, but she'd been mistaken. The theory was sound, its practice not so easily accomplished. She'd been in company most of the trip with her own thoughts, had been so ever since the dinner with Ruby and Gray. Though Nick and Leo were never far from Cassandra's mind, having the fact of their deaths remarked upon so openly, so unexpectedly, had brought the fracturing moment crashing back. It had been so sudden. She supposed such things always were. One moment she was a wife and mother, the next she was alone. And all for the sake of an uninterrupted hour in which to draw. She'd thrust a thumb-sucking Leo into Nick's arms and sent them to the shops for groceries they didn't need. Nick had grinned at her as he'd started the car down the driveway, and Leo had waved a chubby little hand, still clutching the silk pillowcase he'd taken to carrying everywhere. Cassandra had waved back absently, her mind already in her studio. Worst of all was how much she'd relished the hour and a half before the knock came on her door. She hadn't even noticed how long they'd been gone. Nell had been Cassandra's savior for a second time. She'd come straight away, brought Ben with her. He'd been able to explain what had happened, the words that had made no sense from the policeman's lips. An accident, a swerving truck, a collision. A ghastly sequence of events, so mundane, so ordinary, it was impossible to believe that they were happening to her. Nell hadn't told Cassandra it would be all right. She'd understood better than that, had known that it would never, could never be all right. She'd come armed instead with pills to help Cassandra sleep, to deliver a blessed blow to her racing mind and make it all disappear, if only for a few hours. And then she'd taken Cassandra home with her. It was better back at Nell's. The ghosts weren't as comfortable there. Nell's place had its own set, and the ones Cassandra brought didn't have quite the same free run. Time afterwards was a haze of grief and horror and nightmares that couldn't be shed with the new day. She wasn't sure which were worse, the nights that Nick filled her thoughts, his ghost asking over and over, "Why did you make us go? Why did you make me take Leo?" Or the nights when he wouldn't come, when she was alone, and the dark hours threatened to stretch interminably, the partial salvation of the dawn rushing away from her faster than she could ever hope to chase it. And then there was the dream, the hateful field with its promise of finding them. During the days, it was Leo who trailed her, the noise of his toys, a cry, a little hand grabbing at her skirt, begging to be lifted into her arms and held. Oh, the flicker of unabated joy in her heart, momentary, fractured, but real nonetheless. The split second in which she forgot. Then the thud of reality when she turned to scoop him up and he wasn't there. She had tried going out, had thought she might escape them that way, but it hadn't worked. There'd been so many children everywhere she went. The parks, the schools, the shops. Had there always been so many? So she'd stayed home, spent the days in Nell's yard, lying on her back beneath the old mango tree and watching the clouds waft overhead. The perfect blue sky behind the frangipani leaves, the fluttering of the palm fronds, tiny star-shaped seeds dislocated by the breeze to rain over the path below. Thinking of nothing. Trying to think of nothing. Thinking of everything. That was where Nell had found her on an afternoon in April. The season had just begun to turn, summer's swelter had lifted, and there was a hint of impending autumn in the air. Cassandra's eyes were closed. The first she realized that Nell was standing nearby was the loss of warmth from the skin on her arms and the slight darkening inside her eyelids. Then a voice. "Thought I'd find you out here." Cassandra said nothing. "Do you think it might be time you started doing something, Cass?" "Please, Nell, leave it alone." Slower, more clearly enunciated. "You need to start doing something." "Please." To pick up a pencil made her physically ill. As for opening one of her sketchbooks, how could she bear to risk glimpsing the swell of a plump cheek, the tip of an upturned nose, the arc of kissable baby lips? "You need to do something." Nell was just trying to help, and yet there was a part of Cassandra that wanted to scream and shake her grandmother, punish her for this failure to understand. Instead, she sighed. Her lids, still closed, fluttered a little. "I hear it enough from Dr. Harvey. I don't need it from you, too." "I don't mean therapeutically, Cass." A brief hesitation before Nell continued. "I mean you need to start contributing." Cassandra's eyes opened. She lifted a hand to block the glare. "What?" "I'm not a spring chicken, my love. I need some help. Around the house, in the shop, financially." The offending sentences shimmered in the bright air, sharp edges refusing to dissipate. How could Nell be so cold, so thoughtless? Cassandra shivered. "My family is gone," she managed finally, her throat aching with the effort. "I'm grieving."
"I know that," said Nell, easing herself down to sit by Cassandra. She reached out and clutched her hand. "I know that, my darling girl. But it's been 6 months, and you are not dead." Cassandra was crying now. It was saying the words out loud that did it. "You are here," said Nell softly, squeezing Cassandra's hand. "And I need help."
"I can't."
"You can."
"No."
Her head was throbbing. She was tired, so tired.
"I mean, I can't. I have nothing to give."
"I don't need you to give me anything. I just need you to come with me and do as I ask. You can hold a polishing cloth, can't you?"
Nell had reached out then to stroke Cassandra's hair from her cheeks, sticky with tears. Her voice was low, unexpectedly steely.
"You'll beat this. I know it doesn't feel like it, but you will. You're a survivor."
"I don't want to survive it."
"I know that too," Nell had said. "And it's fair enough. But sometimes we don't have a choice."
The hotel kettle switched itself off with a triumphant click, and Cassandra poured water over the tea bag, hand shaking a little. Stood for a moment as it drew. She realized now that Nell really had understood, that she knew all too well the sudden, blinding emptiness of having one's ties cut. She stirred her tea and sighed quietly as Nick and Leo retreated once more, forced herself to focus on the present. She was at the Blackhurst Hotel in Tregenna, Cornwall, listening as the waves of an unfamiliar ocean crashed upon the sands of an unfamiliar beach.
Beyond the dark heads of the tallest trees, a lone bird cut black across an inky sky, and moonlight rippled on the faraway ocean surface. Tiny lights winked at the shore. Fishing boats, Cassandra figured. Tregenna was a fishing village, after all. Strange in this modern world, it was a surprise to find a pocket where things were still done in the old way, on a small scale, as they had been done for generations. Cassandra took a sip and exhaled warmly. She was in Cornwall, just as Nell had been before her. Rose and Nathaniel and Eliza Makepeace before that. As she whispered their names to herself, she felt an odd tingling beneath her skin, like tiny threads all being pulled at the same time. She had a purpose here, and it was not to wallow in her own past. "Here I am, Nell," she said softly. "Is this what you wanted me to do?" Chapter 23, Blackhurst Manor, 1900. When Eliza woke next morning, it took her a moment to remember where she was. She seemed to be lying in a huge wooden sleigh with a deep blue canopy suspended above. Her nightdress was of the type to have Mrs. Swindle rubbing her hands together with glee, and Sammy's dirty clothing was bunched beneath her head. Then she remembered. The do-gooders, Mr. Newton, the carriage ride, the bad man. She was at her uncle and aunt's house. There had been a storm, lightning, thunder, and rain. Sammy's face in the window. Eliza scrambled onto the window seat and looked outside, was forced to squint. The rain and thunder of the night before had been rolled away by the dawn, and the light, the air, was all washed clean. Leaves and branches lay strewn across the lawn, and a garden seat directly beneath the window had been blown over. Her attention was drawn to a distant corner of the garden. Someone, a man, moved amongst the greenery. He had a black beard and was dressed in overalls, a strange little green hat, and black galoshes. A noise behind her, and Eliza turned. The door to the room was open, and a young maid with emphatically curly hair was placing a tray on the bedside table. It was the same maid who had received a scolding the night before. "Morning, miss," she said. "My name's Mary, and I've brought you some breakfast. Mrs. Hopkins said you could have it in your room this morning, on account of the long journey you took these past days." Eliza hurried to sit at the little table. Her eyes widened as she took in the contents of the tray. Hot bread rolls with lashings of melting butter. White pots filled to the brim with the fruitiest conserves she had ever seen. A pair of kippers. A pile of fluffy egg. A fat, glistening sausage. Her heart sang. "That were quite a storm you brought with you last night," said Mary, strapping the curtains back. "I almost didn't make it home. Thought for a time I were going to need to stay here the night." Eliza swallowed a lump of bread. "You don't live here?" Mary laughed. "No fear. Might be all right for the rest of them. But I shouldn't like to live..." She glanced at Eliza, a pink glow warming her cheeks. "That is, I live in the village, with my ma and pa and my brothers and sister."
"You have a brother?"
As Eliza thought of Sammy, the emptiness yawned inside her. "Oh, yes, indeed. Three of them. Two older and one younger. Though Patrick, the eldest, don't live at home no more. Still works on the fishing boats with my pa, though. He, Will, and Pa go out every day, whatever the weather. The younger, Rowley, he's only three. He stays at home with my ma and little May." She plumped the cushions on the window seat.
We Martins have always worked on the sea. My great-grandfather was one of the Tregenna pirates.
The what?
The Tregenna pirates, said Mary, eyes widening with incredulity. Have you not heard of them? Eliza shook her head. The Tregenna pirates were the most fearsome bunch you'd ever find. They ruled the seas in their time, bringing back whiskey and pepper when the folk at home couldn't get them otherwise. Only ever took from the rich, mind you. Just like what's-his-name, except on the ocean, not in the forest. There's passages winding right the way through these hills. One or two reach all the way to the sea.
Where is the sea, Mary? Said Eliza. Is it near?
Mary looked at her strangely again.
Well, of course it is, Poppet. Can't you hear it?
Eliza paused and listened. Could she hear the sea?
Listen, said Mary. Whoosha, whoosha, whoosha. That there's the sea, breathing in and out as it always does.
Could you really not hear it?
I could hear it, said Eliza. I just didn't know it was the sea.
Didn't know it was the sea? Mary grinned. What on God's earth did you think it was?
I thought it was a train.
A train? Mary erupted into laughter. You are the ticket. The station's a way off from here. Thought the sea were a train indeed. Just you wait until I tell my brothers.
Eliza thought of the few stories Mother had told about sand and silver shingles and wind that smelled like salt.
Could I go and look at the sea, Mary?
I reckon you could. So long as you make sure and be back when cook rings the luncheon bell. The mistress is out visiting this morning, so she won't be here to notice.
A cloud came across Mary's cheerful face when she mentioned the mistress.
Just you mind your back before she is, you hear? She's one for rules and order, and not to be crossed.
How do I get there?
Mary beckoned Eliza towards the window. Come over here, and I'll show you, Poppet.
The air was different here, and the sky. It seemed brighter and further away. Not like the grey lid that hung low over London, threatening, always threatening to close upon it. This sky was lifted high by sea breezes, like a great white sheet on laundering day, with the air caught beneath it, billowing higher and higher. Eliza stood at cliff's edge looking out across the cove towards the deep blue sea, the very same sea her father had sailed upon, the beach her mother had known when she was a girl. The storm of the night before had left driftwood scattered across the pale shore. Elegant white branches, gnarled and polished by time, emerged from the pebbles like the antlers of some great ghostly beast. Eliza could taste salt in the air, just as Mother had always said. Out of the confines of the strange house, she felt suddenly light and free. She took a deep breath and started down the wooden steps, scuttling faster and faster, eager to be at the bottom. Once she reached the shore, she sat on a smooth rock and unlaced her boots, fingers tripping over themselves to complete the task. She rolled the hems of Sammy's breeches so that they sat above her knees. Then she picked her way towards the water's edge. Stones, smooth and spiky alike, were warm beneath her feet. She stood for a moment, observing as the great blue mass heaved in and out, in and out. Then, with a deep, salty breath, she skipped forward so that her toes, her ankles, her knees were wet. She followed the shoreline, laughing at the cool bubbles between her toes, picking up shells that took her fancy,
and, once, a piece of sea debris, shaped like a star. It was a small cove with a deep curve, and it didn't take long for Eliza to travel the entire length of its shore. When she reached the end, proximity gave a third dimension to what had seemed, at a distance, a mere dark patch. A huge black crag emerged from the bluff and charged into the sea. It was shaped like a mighty puff of angry black smoke that had been frozen in time, cursed to an eternal solidity. Properly part of neither land, nor sea, nor air. The black rock was slippery, but Eliza found a ledge at its rim, just deep enough to stand on. She hunted out jagged footholds and scrambled up the rock's side. Didn't stop until she'd made it to the very top. She was so high, she couldn't look down without feeling that her head was filled with bubbles. On hands and knees, she inched forward. It became narrower and narrower, until finally she was at the furthest point. She sat on the rock's raised fist and laughed breathlessly. It was like being at the top of a great ship. Beneath her, the white froth of dueling waves. Before her, the open sea. The sun had set hundreds of lights to shimmering on its surface, rising and rippling with the breeze, all the way towards the clear, unbroken horizon. Directly in front, she knew, was France. Beyond Europe was the East, India, Egypt, Persia, and the other exotic places she'd heard humming on the lips of the Thames Rivermen. Beyond even that was the Far East, the other side of the earth. Watching the vast ocean, the flickering sunlight, thinking of the distant lands, Eliza was enveloped by a feeling quite unlike any she'd experienced before. A warmth, a glimpse of possibility, an absence of wariness. She leaned forward and squinted. The horizon was unbroken no more. Something had appeared, a big black ship with full sails, balanced on the line where sea met sky, as if about to slip over the rim of the world. Eliza blinked, and when her eyes opened again, the ship was gone. It had disappeared into the distance, she supposed. How swiftly ships must move in the open sea, how strong their wide, white sails. That was the sort of ship her father would have sailed upon, she thought. Eliza allowed her attention to drift skywards. A gull was circling above, calling out, camouflaged against the white sky. She followed its path until something on the cliff top caught her eye. There was a cottage, almost hidden by trees. She could just make out its roof and a funny little window that stuck out on top. She wondered what it would be like to live in such a place, right on the edge of the world like that. Would it always feel as if you were about to topple over and slide into the ocean? Eliza started as cold water sprayed her face. She looked down at the swirling sea. The tide was coming in, the water rising quickly. The ledge she had first stepped upon was under water now. She crawled back along the ridge of the rock and went carefully down, keeping to the deepest edge so she could wrap her fingers around the craggy side. When she was almost at water level, she paused. From this angle, she could see that the rock wasn't solid. It was as if someone had carved out a great hole. A cave? That's what it was. Eliza thought of Mary's Tregenna pirates, their tunnels. That's what this cave was. She was sure of it. Hadn't Mary said the pirates used to traffic their loot through a series of caves that ran beneath the cliffs? Eliza shimmied around the front of the rock and scrambled onto the flattish platform. She took a few steps inside. It was dark and moist. "Hello!" she called out. Her voice echoed pleasingly, lapped against the walls before fading away to nothing. She couldn't see far beyond, but felt a thrill of excitement. Her very own cave. She would come back here one day, she determined, with a lantern, so that she could see what lay inside. A thudding sound, distant but drawing near. Ka-thud, 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 Eliza's first thought was that it issued from within the cave. Fear glued her feet to the spot as she wondered what sort of sea monster was coming for her.
Kathud! Kathud! Kathud!
Louder now. She backed away slowly, started picking her way to the side of the rock. Then, tearing along the ridge of the cliff, she saw a pair of shiny black horses dragging a carriage behind them. Not a sea monster after all, but Newton and his carriage on the cliff road, the sound amplified as it bounced between the rock walls of the cove. She remembered Mary's warning. The aunt had gone out for the morning, but was expected back for luncheon. Eliza was not to be late. She clambered along the rock and jumped clear onto the pebbly shore, ran through the shallow water, then back up the beach. Eliza laced her boots and bounded up the steps. The bottoms of her breeches were wet, and the hems slapped heavily against her ankles as she wound her way back along the track between the trees. The sun had shifted since she'd come down to the cove, and now the path was dim and cool. It was like being in a burrow, a secret bramble burrow, home to fairies and goblins and elves. They were hiding, watching her as she tiptoed through their world. She scrutinized the undergrowth as she went, tried not to blink, in the hopes she might catch one unawares. For everybody knew, a fairy glimpsed was bound to grant her finder's wishes. A noise, and Eliza froze, held her breath. In the clearing before her was a man. A real live man. The one with the black beard, whom she'd seen from her bedroom window that morning. He was sitting on a log, unwrapping a checked piece of cloth. Inside was a meaty wedge of pastry. Eliza drew herself to the side of the path and watched him. The tips of tiny naked branches caught the ends of her short hair as she climbed cautiously onto a low bough, all the better to observe. The man had a barrow beside him, full of dirt. Or so it seemed. Eliza knew that was a mere ruse, that beneath the dirt he had his treasures stored. For he was a pirate king, of course. One of the Tregenna pirates, or the ghost of a Tregenna pirate. An undead seafarer waiting to take revenge for the deaths of his comrades. A ghost with unfinished business, waiting in his lair to capture little girls to take home for his wife to bake into pies. That was the ship she'd seen out at sea, the big black ship that had disappeared in the blink of an eye. It was a ghost ship, and he... The branch she was perched upon snapped, and Eliza tumbled to the ground, landed in a mound of moist leaves. The bearded man barely moved a muscle. His right eyeball seemed to swivel slightly in Eliza's direction as he continued to chew his pasty. Eliza stood, rubbed at her knee, then straightened, pulled a dry leaf from her hair. "You're the new little lady," he said slowly, masticated pasty turning to glue inside his mouth.
"I heard talk you'd come. Though if you don't mind me saying, you don't look much of a lady. What with those lads' clothes and your hair all torn up like that?"
"I came last night. I brought the storm with me."
"That's quite a power you've got for such a small thing."
"With a strong enough will, even the weak can wield great power." A furry caterpillar eyebrow twitched.
"Who told you that?"
"My mother." Eliza remembered too late that she wasn't supposed to mention her mother. Heart flickering, she waited to see what the man would say. He stared at her, chewing slowly.
"I dare say she knew what she were talking about. Mothers tend towards right. On most things."
The warm pins and needles of relief. "My mother died."
"So did mine."
"I'm living here now." He nodded.
"I'd say you are."
"My name is Eliza."
"And mine is Davies."
You're very old.
As old as me little finger, and a bit older than me teeth.
Eliza took a deep breath. Are you a pirate?
He laughed, a deep chuffing sound like smoke from a dirty chimney.
Sorry to disappoint you, my girl. I'm a gardener. Just like my daddy afore me. Maze keeper, to be particular about it.
Eliza wrinkled her nose.
Maze keeper?
I keep the maze tended.
When Eliza's face showed no dawn of clarity, Davies pointed at the tall twin hedges behind him, bridged by an iron gate.
"'Tis a puzzle, made from edges. The object, to find a way through, without winding up lost.
A puzzle that could fit a person inside? Eliza had never heard of such a thing. Where does it lead?
Oh, it weaves back and forth. If you're lucky enough to follow it right the way through, you'll find yourself on the other side of the estate. If you're not so lucky, his eyes widened ominously, you'll likely perish of starvation before anyone knows you're missing.
He leaned towards her, lowered his voice.
I oft-times come across the bones of such unlucky souls.
Thrills squeezed Eliza's voice to a whisper.
And if I made it through? What would I find at the other end?
Another garden, a special garden, and a little cottage, right on the edge of the cliff.
I saw the cottage from the beach.
He nodded.
I'd say you probably did.
Whose house is it? Who lives there?
No one know. Lord Archibald Mountrashay, your great-grandfather, he'd have been. He had it built when he were in charge. There's somewhat says it were built as a lookout, a signalling post.
For the smugglers, the Tregenna pirates,
he smiled.
I can tell young Mary Martin's had your ear.
Can I go and see it?
You'll never find it.
I will.
His eyes twinkled as he teased.
Never. You'll never find your way through the maze. Even if you do, you'll never work out how to get through the secret gate and into the cottage garden.
I will. Let me try, please, Davies.
I'm afraid it ain't possible, Miss Eliza,
Davies said, sobering somewhat.
There's no one been right the way through the maze in quite a time. I keep it maintained to a point, but I only go so far as I'm allowed. It's bound to be grown over in parts beyond.
Why has no one been through?
Your uncle had it closed some time past. No one's been through since.
He leaned towards her.
Your mother. Now there's someone who knew the maze like the back of her hand. Almost as well as I.
A bell sounded in the distance. Davies took his hat off and wiped his sweaty forehead.
You'd better be off like starshot, then, miss. That's the luncheon bell.
Are you coming to have your luncheon, too?
He laughed.
The staff don't eat luncheon, Miss Eliza. That's not proper. They have their dinner now.
Are you coming up to have your dinner, then?
I don't eat inside the house. Haven't done for a long time.
Why not?
It's not a place I like to be.
Eliza didn't understand.
Why not?
Davies stroked his beard.
I'm happier when I stick to my plants, Miss Eliza.
There is some that are made for the society of men, others that ain't. I'm one of the latter, happy on me own dung heap.
But why?
He exhaled slowly, like a great weary giant. Certain places make a man's hairs stand on end, disagree with a man's way of being. Do you see what I'm seeing?
Eliza thought of her aunt in the burgundy room the night before, the hound and the shadows and the candlelight lashing angrily at the walls. She nodded.
Young Mary, no, she's a good lass. She'll look out for you up at the house.
He frowned a little as he stared down at her.
It doesn't do to trust too easily, Miss Eliza. Doesn't do at all. You hear?
Eliza nodded solemnly, because solemnity seemed to be called for.
No, be off with you, young miss. You'll be late for luncheon, and the mistress will have your heart on a supper tree. She don't like her rules broken, and that's a fact.
Eliza smiled, though Davies did not. She turned to go, stopped when she saw something in the upper window, something she'd seen the day before. A face, small and watchful.
Who's that? She said.
Davies turned and squinted up towards the house, nodded slightly in the direction of the upper window.
I reckon that's Miss Rose.
Miss Rose?
Your cousin. Your aunt and uncle's girl.
Eliza's eyes widened. Her cousin?
We used to see quite a lot of her about the estate. Bright young thing she was. But some years ago she took ill, and that was the end of that. The mistress spends all her time and a fair bit of money trying to fix whatever's wrong, and the young doctor from town's always coming and going.
Eliza was still staring up at the window. Slowly she raised her hand, fingers wide like the starfish from the beach. She waved back and forth, watched as the face disappeared quickly into the dark. A slight smile pulled at Eliza's face. Rose, she said, tasting the sweetness of the word. It was just like the name of a princess in a fairy tale. Chapter 24, Cliff Cottage, 2005. The wind whipped through Cassandra's hair, twirling her ponytail inside out, outside in, like streamers on a windsock. She pulled her cardigan tight around her shoulders and paused a moment to catch her breath, looked back down the narrow coastal road to the village below. Tiny white cottages clung like barnacles to the rocky cove, and red and blue fishing boats dotted the Denham harbour, bobbing on the swell as gulls swooped and spiralled above their halls. The air, even at this height, was laden with salt licked from the sea's surface. The road was so narrow and so close to the cliff's edge that Cassandra wondered how anyone ever worked up the